you can't literally buy love in the sense of walking into a store and being like, yes, one love, please. But if you're too poor to go out on dates, and if you can't afford, it's very stressful trying to keep a happy romantic relationship together when you're under permanent financial stress. Yes. And it's a lot harder than if you can afford to pay someone to take care of all dishes and kids. So there are so many ways in which it's misleading to say that love and money have nothing to do with each other. They have a lot to do with each other.
Welcome to the Multi-Amory Podcast. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
We believe in looking to the future of relationships, not maintaining the status quo of the past.
So whether you're monogamous, polyamorous, swinging, casually dating, or if you just do relationships differently, we see you and we're here for you.
On this episode of the Multi-Amory Podcast, we are back with author and philosophy professor Carrie Jenkins to discuss her new book, Sad Love, Romance, and the Search for Meaning. Now, this was surprising to me to find out, but it has been 6 years since Carrie was on our show last. If you want to check out that episode, it is Multi-Amory episode 113. Versus this one, which is 399. So
my
just
goodness.
Goes to show how long ago that
was. Carrie, you're here on the cusp of almost 400 episodes in six years plus the 200 years that has been the pandemic. So even
longer. I was going to say, yeah, that counts for at least 200
years.
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for joining us again.
Mm-hmm. It's a pleasure to be here. I can't believe it's been 6 years.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, first off, I just wanted to ask, in that time, just how have you been? Have there been like any huge updates in your life or changes in the work that you do? And also, because you write about love and you write about so many things that we talk about on this show, do you think that the landscape of love and relationships have changed in the 6 years since we last spoke to you?
Oh, wow. Yes. I mean, everything has changed. Everything has changed. The book that I just published, I took years longer to write it than I wanted to and originally planned to, because the world just kept changing and you can't really write. I couldn't really write at the beginning of the pandemic. I just stopped. You know, I couldn't see what the world I was trying to talk into was going to be. So how do you talk to a future that you are so radically unsure about? How I've been, I mean, I've been all over the shop. I had a long period of depression after my first book came out. And I mean, that's partly what the second book is about, among other things, and how that kind of impacted my relationships and how it made me think about relationships and happiness and romance and the happy ever after myth and all of those things. But I mean, the book ended up being not bigger in the sense of a huge weighty tome or anything, but the ideas sort of got bigger. I ended up having a much bigger scope than I had in the first book, and I think bigger than I had intended when I started writing the second book.
Sure.
And I think that had a lot to do with the pandemic, honestly. Like, it just kind of forced people to get some perspective that we didn't have before.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I feel like I could talk about that for several hours straight at this point. I want to rewind talking about the way you felt after the first book came out. And it's funny because I think I went through that after my book came out. I have other author friends who've gone through that. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that process, like going through that dark valley and
especially
coming out of it?
We're all about to publish a book.
Right,
Jason
Emily and Jace are about to be first-time authors, so y'all got to get ready for that, for the postpartum.
Yeah. No one told me about this part. Jeez.
I know, right?
It's a thing. I mean, absolutely, it's a thing. And I mean, a lot of it depends on what kind of book you publish and what kind of response you get from the world. But in my case, the experience was of being not unprepared in the sense that I didn't know it was coming, but unprepared in the sense that I didn't know what it would be like to go through having a little bit more of a public profile and just really getting waves and waves of hateful feedback. Like every time I would be in a more high visibility interview or press coverage, people would mention that I was polyamorous and I was in more than one relationship, and I would get this just waves of slut shaming and horrible stuff. And lots of it was also racist, which was really upsetting to, you know, being a white woman and then having had that privilege of largely having racism kind of hidden from my view for most of my life. It was just horrific to see what people were saying about my partners, and knowing that it was because of their association with me that they were being exposed to that. Mm. So, I mean, all of this kind of was swirling around, and I had other things going on in my life too. It wasn't just about that. But that was a big part of it. I think I spent maybe a good couple of years going through some pretty rough times. I was very lucky. I had support all the way through from partners, family, friends, and a very good medical team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, most people I know who've had to go through something like that have had to do it with less help than I had. And so I'm just eternally grateful and for having had that. In this book, I end up talking about basically some of the forms that gratitude takes and my understanding of what it is that I'm grateful for out of that process, and just trying to think about how to expand from that experience into a broader view about love itself.
Yeah. So I would say that I think the three of us can definitely resonate with that experience. You know, anytime the three of us together or individually have like done interviews in it's even slightly more mainstream leaning mm-hmm. media or shows or whatever, that it is like this big slap in the face of like, oh, right, there is this whole mainstream current of thought that's so disgusted and so scared by thinking about love in these particular terms. And in your newest book, you shared this story of like, you know, giving this philosophy presentation, and it was supposed to be about all the things you write about in your book, about the ways that we view love and relationship, and everybody glommed on to the whole polyamory thing. And then people are asking you questions about how you manage STIs and things like that. So I was wondering, like, in the world that you move in around philosophers, like, do you think that this is a subculture that brings with it its own slightly conservative bent? Or do you think that just like philosophers, like everyone else, are subject to the same like mainstream messaging around relationships and reinforcing that stigma of people who are non-normative? Like, what's your take on that?
It's a weird one, but I feel like academics, and maybe even especially academic philosophers, who you might think would be some of the most open-minded, like critical thinking people, it can really go in the opposite direction sometimes, and around certain kinds of issues. Academia can be, you know, a really horrible place sometimes. There's a lot of systemic racism, there's a lot of misogyny, there's a lot of transphobia, especially in academic philosophy, especially in the UK, in fact, for whatever reason, that seems to have really focused around academic philosophy, and there are the arguments of a few people. And I don't know exactly why it is, but one of my theories is it has to do with that phenomenon that's sometimes called self-licensing, where if you tell yourself you're good in some way, you've kind of given yourself permission actually to be not so good in that way. So people, before they have to do some, you know, job evaluations or something like that, if they tell themselves before doing it that they are very objective and unbiased, they're actually slightly more likely to be biased in how they rank the applications for the job. So it's kind of like, if you're an academic philosopher and you go around all the time sort of congratulating yourself on how very rational and clever and critical you are, then maybe that kind of licenses you a little bit to be a little less those things than might be ideal. So I don't know, but I mean academia can be for all it's kind of, it gets this weird press as a hotbed of radical left-wing thinking, It can be really surprisingly unprogressive about a lot of stuff, and that caricature doesn't ring at all true to my experience. I think it is quite a conservative, quite stuffy place at times.
Yeah. And I think it makes sense. Yeah, I was just going to make the comment. I think it makes sense how that also layers on top of the fact that even just a very common cognitive bias for all human beings is to think that we're less biased than the average person.
Right? You know,
and I'm sure
we all want to think we're great.
Yeah, really turn the volume up.
We're probably not that great.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And what did you say this concept was called? Is licensing?
Self-licensing, yeah.
Self-licensing,
sometimes called moral licensing or moral self-licensing.
Wow. I mean, I feel like we could do a whole episode just right now talking about that, which is reminding me of 6 years ago, where it's just like, I just want to keep talking about all the things that you bring up. I love that. But I am going to bring us back to the book, though, because that is what we're here to talk about. You start off the book, Sad Love, by interrogating the relationship between happiness and love. So could you start out by telling us a little bit about what did you find when you looked at that relationship and, you know, the ideological role of happiness and how we think about that in relation to love?
Yeah, I mean, it all got started with just thinking about how often we hear the phrase or hear phrases that assume that love and romantic love in particular should make you happy if successful. You know, if it's going well. So we ask, are you happy with this person? Are you happy together? To ask, is the relationship good? And we talk about, obviously, the happy ever after. And one thing I noticed was that this seems to track a much bigger situation, which is this emphasis on positive emotion more generally, especially in North American culture. And this is something that I talk about a little bit in detail in the first chapter or so of the book. But the idea that really happiness is like a emotional success, and that each person is responsible for their own emotional success. So you have to become happy, and that's how you'll prove that you're like a successful, emotionally successful person. So it's a bit like sort of the American dream idea that to become rich is to be successful and everyone can succeed financially in America, right? That's the idea. And they're
I don't know if you've been to America, Carrie, but it's
true. To start with.
That's a fact.
Oh, yeah. This is what I hear. Yeah. Every time I've been there, it seems exactly like that. So I just assume that's completely true. And then overlaid on that, you get this kind of what's sometimes called toxic positivity, which is the idea that happiness and good vibes are the only acceptable emotional states, and anything like anger or sadness is a sign of failure or a sign that you're just not a good person to be around, and complaining and so on. You shouldn't be around complainers. So I kind of put a bunch of these thoughts together and associate them with the kind of platitudes that we tend to exchange when we're talking about what a good life is. And we say things like, well, good life is one that's full of love. A good life is one that's full of happiness. Right? Again, those two things taken as kind of almost the same goal, the same end state for a good life. And then we say things like, oh, and the best things in life are free. So love and happiness, those are supposed to be free, i.e. everybody should be able to succeed on those terms, like however rich or poor you are when you're starting out. And then, you know, we start to kind of build around that the idea that a good life is going to be aiming at a certain kind of love, the kind that is associated with that happy ever after, the romantic dream. And this becomes, or is, I should say, a normative status, a normative goal for everybody, whether or not we buy into it, right? Because, of course, lots of us are aware that's not the ideal life condition for everybody. The traditional, I'm using scare quotes here, the traditional nuclear family shape of romantic relationship is not everybody's life goal, but everybody is still subject to it as a bar that they can be measured against and found wanting if they're not meeting that condition.
Yeah, I think what you're touching on about positive emotions being weighed a little bit too heavily in a lot of Western, Northwestern cultures, it does strike me that on the underside of that is sort of, yeah, this idea that like suffering, instead of suffering just being a part of life, that suffering is a failure of some kind. Mm-hmm. If you're suffering, mm-hmm. you're failing in some way. You're failing either materially or you just don't have the right attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. that somehow it's your job to fix that. So you're not grateful enough. You're not journaling enough. You're not doing enough yoga. You're not eating the right foods. And you know, like I'm not knocking any of those things and I know they can help people, but if we only look at the individualistic level, it's sort of like trying to understand why some people are poor by just looking at how hard they work mm-hmm. and not at the social circumstances that they find themselves in. And I think the exact same kind of conditions should be taken into account when we're trying to think about why some people are struggling in love, why some people are struggling to experience happiness. And instead of understanding that those things are actually part of a complicated and dynamic social structure, we have a tendency to think of them as purely individual and private things. So completely right. nothing to do with anything political, nothing to do with any social prejudices, nothing to do with privilege, nothing, et cetera. And that's part of what saying that the best things in life are free does. Tells us. Yeah, nothing to see here.
Right. Kind of erases all that other context around it.
Yeah.
And just,
yeah.
It's all your own fault, whichever way it goes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think also yeah. on the other side is that thing that we see come up with. We also see this come up with money and career success and things like that. It's that if I'm successful, it's all because of how hard I worked or how smart I was or yeah. how clever I was or yeah. something.
Exactly. Yeah.
Totally discounting luck, privilege, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. a billion other factors that went into that. And with love, it's yeah. the same thing. So, yeah. Yeah, that makes
very much
sense. So.
Yeah. And of course, you know, you can't literally buy love in the sense of walking into a store and being like, yes, one love, please. but if you're too poor to go out on dates and, you know, if you can't afford, it's very stressful trying to keep a happy romantic relationship together when you're under permanent financial stress. Yes. And mm-hmm. it's a lot harder than if you can afford to pay someone to take care of all the dishes and the kids, right?
Right.
So there's so many ways in which it's misleading to say that love and money have nothing to do with each other. They have they have a lot to do with each other.
Yeah. Well, so I want to bring us around to this concept that you talk about in the book quite a bit, which is eudaimonic love. Now, I was first introduced to this concept when you included it in part of a quote for our book, which threw all of us for a loop and our copy editor for a loop as well. For our listeners at home, this is, I'll spell it out for you, eudaimonic love, eudaimonic love. And so, yeah, this is the main principle of the book. So can you, in a nutshell, tell us what this is? And I mean, also you set this up as kind of a counterpoint to romantic love.
Good, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the way that I see it, romantic love, and not the love part, but the romanticness part, is really defined by this normative fairy tale, you know, and it's monogamous, it's permanent, it's happy ever after. It's all of those things. And eudaimonic love is not defined by any of that at all. Eudaimonia is an ancient Greek word, and it's quite often associated with the philosopher Aristotle, because he talked about eudaimonia. He used it to mean something like human flourishing or flourishing in general, but for humans, it would be a particularly distinctively human kind of flourishing. I don't really care for Aristotle's theory of what that amounts to, so I'm just going to leave him there. But before Aristotle got his hands on the word, the original meaning of it was good spirited. So the EU in EU at the beginning there is the same EU as you find in euphoria. It means good. And then the daimonia, that word daimon means any kind of supernatural entity, a spirit, maybe a god or a demigod or something that could intercede or intervene for you and help you out. So eudaimonia originally would have been talking about living a life that was good-spirited and was benefiting from the interventions of benevolent deities and supernatural forces and all of that sort of thing. And that's the meaning I'm interested in. Not that you necessarily have to interpret it in any supernatural way. But what I want to think about is all of the ways in which any kind of relationship is always subject to the daimons, the spirits around it. So not just to be eudaimonic, to have good spirits, a relationship doesn't just need for the people in it to be good-spirited people for one another and in general. It's also going to be impacted by the community, the vibe, the time and the place, the politics, the state of the world. But I mean, the support of friends and family, things like that can really make or break love relationship. And so I was trying to make room for the role of all of those different kinds of good spirits in supporting and making love possible, and making it something that is creative, that is collaborative, that looks beyond just the role of individuals in this world, into something that has a bigger goal. So a eudaimonic love doesn't have to be a romantic love. So it doesn't have to be between a romantic couple, as we might think about. Eudaimonic love could be between friends. It could be between family members. What I want to do is say we put romance and romantic love on a kind of pedestal, and we've associated it and happiness that goes along with it as the best things in life, and so that everyone should aim at those things. Eudaimonia and eudaimonic love, in my view, are not defined by any kind of emotion. So in fact, they have room for all of the human emotions. The full range of human experience and emotion can be part of a good-spirited love. And instead of aiming at happiness, what I say a eudaimonic love would aim at is more like a creative work of art, right? Something collaborative, some kind of meaningful project that the people who are in the loving relationship undertake together. So whether that's to raise kids or, you know, paint a great mural on the walls of this city, or, you know, really anything, to discover the fundamental physics of the universe. It doesn't matter what it is that makes people's lives and loves meaningful. The point is to look for those things that make your experience of life meaningful, and stop thinking about what makes you happy. Because there's another part of this, which is, this is not a new point that I'm making. A lot of philosophers have been saying this for a very long time. Aiming at happiness doesn't work, right? Trying to make yourself happy actually doesn't tend to make people very happy. And I think the same is true for trying to make yourself happy ever after in the romantic sense. It doesn't actually work. It's not going to lead to happy ever after for the majority of people. And I draw on the work of Viktor Frankl, who was really influential in saying that if you are going after happiness, you're unlikely to succeed. But what you need to do is go after what makes your life meaningful, what has meaning for you. That's actually why the book has the subtitle Romance and the Search for Meaning. It's a nod to Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning.
Okay, right. It's interesting because we bring up that topic a lot anytime we talk about positive psychology stuff on our podcast, is that idea that, contrary to what you might think from its name, it's not all about being happy all the time. It's about that wellness, right, of finding meaning and, you know, something deeper than just being happy all the time, because that's not realistic and it's not achievable, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, there's a little part of the book where I talk about the positive psychology wars and that segment of academic research has kind of flowed into popular culture, and how its uptake has sometimes been seen as spawning toxic positivity.
Right.
But I don't actually end up taking it. I don't have a horse in that race. I think there's a lot that goes on under the aegis of positive psychology that looks at what does in fact lead to the kind of things I would call eudaimonic And that has a lot to do with things like flow states, you know, practicing projects that take you a long time to accomplish and require you to be fully immersed and engaged. Are in that respect pretty different from binging on Netflix or spending money on Amazon or whatever the other things are that we tend to do when we're tired after a long day at work for a quick hit of happiness. So that kind of research, I think, is really useful for understanding what eudaimonia is and how it works. And indeed, it tends to back up some of what those much earlier philosophers were saying about the pure pursuit of happiness or pleasure for its own sake is really a pretty futile enterprise. You have to aim at something else and you will become happy in the pursuit of that, hopefully, if it goes well.
I guess, this leads into our next question, which you've talked about both a bit already, but you discussed the happiness paradox and the romantic paradox throughout the course of the book. So you have already a touch, but can you walk us through what both of those things are so that our audience knows if they were to pick up the book beforehand?
Yeah. So the paradox of happiness, or sometimes called the paradox of hedonism, is just that idea that chasing your own happiness or your own pleasure tends not to make you happy in the long run or even at all. And the romantic paradox, and that's an old problem. Like, people have known about that for at least hundreds of years, maybe longer. My contribution is to add to that this idea of a romantic paradox, which is that in just the same way, the pursuit of happy ever after, the romantic goal, is not likely to lead to being happy ever after. In fact, it can have the opposite kinds of results. And that's part of my critique of romantic love, or the romantic ideology of love, and the idea that in the pursuit of it, we should really focus on the thought that love is a sort of positive feeling or a happy state. Or that it should result in a positive feeling or a happy state, and think much more about how love can be active. So not just a passive feeling that you have, but maybe something you do. Maybe it's about your actions that you might undertake towards another person, or that you might undertake with another person in the service of a community or larger goals.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate, because I think so thinking about the happiness paradox and this idea of like, okay, well, you pursue something that gives your life meaning and value instead of just trying to find the things that make you feel good and make you feel happy. I feel like that's easier to swallow than telling someone, oh, you shouldn't be searching for happily ever after. Because then I could see the reaction, that being like, well, what do you mean? Do you mean I just need to date someone who's like shitty and that I'm not attracted to and that I don't care and I don't have any feelings for? And, you know, like in a realistic sense, how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't recommend any of those things. So this is where the love part is still love. When we think about romantic love, we're encouraged to sort of package love in a certain way, in a certain kind of relationship structure. And it's still got to be love. Otherwise, it's not romantic love. It's not any kind of love. So eudaimonic love is still love. And if you are not feeling it for someone, then you're not feeling it for that person. And what I mean by that is, if you're not doing the kind of things that we would normally take love to consist in, if you're not treating somebody well, let's say, if you're being abusive in a relationship, that's not going to be a loving relationship of any kind. So, you know, it's certainly not going to be a eudaimonic love relationship. In saying that some love relationships are eudaimonic, what I'm really talking about has a lot more to do with what it is that makes what it is that makes a life meaningful, and what it is that makes makes our loves feel meaningful to us. So there's it's very possible to be in a love relationship that is, let's say, subject to being dismissed, being belittled, being hidden away, and being stifled in every way possible. It's still love, but it's not going to be a eudaimonic love, because it's not able to, it's not being supported by good spirits. It's not able to grow. It's not able to exist. Eudaimonic loves It's not about being sad, but it has room for sadness. Not about having a miserable time, but if you are having a miserable time, it doesn't mean your love is a failure. As long as you're being, as long as you're still engaged in these eudaimonic projects, then your love may well be exactly what you need when you're going through this miserable time. The point of eudaimonic love is not to say suffer, but to say humans sometimes suffer, and that too is part of love sometimes.
Yeah, that's great. And that, you know, something we talk a lot about to each other, I actually don't know how often we talk about this on the show, but is in Buddhism, there's the concept of the second arrow of like, sometimes we suffer, and that's the first arrow that you couldn't prevent. But then when we beat ourselves up for the fact that we're suffering, or we dwell on that, that's the second arrow that we're stabbing in ourselves. And that's the one we could avoid. You can't avoid that first one. It just happens. But there's that second one. And what you've been talking about reminds me of that idea of, you know, I'm sad for whatever reason. And then I also feel bad that I'm sad because it means I'm a failure. And so now I'm suffering a second time. I'm suffering extra, possibly even more than I was suffering already from the first reason I was sad. And that makes a lot of sense to think of it that way.
That's it. And if you didn't think that suffering in the first place was a failure condition because you didn't have happiness as your be-all and end-all life goal, then the second arrow wouldn't have any grounds to hit home. You'd just be like, well, this is... my day sucked.
All right, we're going to take a quick break to talk to our listeners about some ways that they can support this show so that we can keep this content coming to everybody out there for free every week. It's something that we really value a lot. And an easy way that you can help support this show is just by taking some time to listen to our advertisers on this. If any are interesting to you, go check them out. It does directly help our show. And if not, that's cool too. We're just happy that you're here.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
And we're back. And I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, which is like this notion, this very Western notion of love is a feeling, or love is about our feelings, which is so interesting to me, because especially as you're talking about this idea of, you know, sad love, which makes room for sadness and all these other emotions, I often struggle when talking about this, sometimes with clients or with listeners, that we have these weird, almost competing narratives about negative feelings within the context of romantic love. That on the one hand, there's sort of the school of thought of, ooh, if you're feeling bad in a relationship, it's not meant to be. You know, if you're not feeling happy all the time or most of the time, you should break up, you should end the relationship. It's not the relationship for you. And then also, almost on the other side of the same coin, we have this narrative around, but relationships are hard work. You gotta, you know, they are struggle. You gotta struggle through it. You gotta keep fighting, you know, marriage is not sexy or, you know, like really glorifying sometimes the negative emotions within the context of romantic love. So, so you kind of make this argument that like, we shouldn't be focusing on it being feelings based at all. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's true. You do sometimes get this narrative that, yeah, marriage is hard work and you have no, you don't get to give 50% and receive 50%. You both give 100% and then, you know, that's 150%. And it's like, well, I don't know. None of that sounds like
something. A lot of fun.
None of that really sounds like, I don't recognize that experience of romantic relationships, particularly. And I mean, I get that it's a different experience for everybody, but I think for part of what's really important to me is this idea of collaboration. So when I talk about eudaimonic love, I try to shift away from some of the romantic metaphors of love being either this kind of dream state or, you know, or perhaps sometimes it's represented as a battlefield or, you know, this idea. So I try to get away from those kinds of metaphors and get into this idea that it's a collaborative work of art, which the idea that it's got something to do with creativity and that it's got something to do with being active, doing something in the world. And that idea, what I'm hoping to speak back to is this this attempt to place feelings at the center of love, whether they're good feelings or bad feelings. What I'm saying is that if you think of love as being ideally, eudaimonically, a pursuit of an activity, then it doesn't have to be about struggle, and it doesn't have to be about the waking up every morning singing that the hills are alive with the sound of music either. It's not about either of those things, right? Those things may both occur and probably will at some point occur, but it's about what makes that thing meaningful for you. That's the point of doing it. And the point of doing it, I mean, I hope for nobody was the point of doing it the struggle part, because like, why? That really does seem like suffering for its own sake. And I get that for a lot of people, that the idea that it would be the point of a romantic relationship would be to have the hills are alive with the sound of music feeling. But what I'm suggesting is that actually that's not stable either. And, you know, if we aim ourselves at that, we are setting ourselves up to fail, and not just to fail ourselves, but to fail our partners as well, and to make unreasonable demands of other people. Like, it's not anybody's job to make me happy. It's not possible to make me happy a lot of the time. Like, when I'm experiencing depression, I'm not going to be happy. That's just not a thing that's going to happen. Doesn't mean I'm not in love. It doesn't mean I'm unlovable or that I can't be engaged in the projects that make my life meaningful. So when I'm talking about eudaimonic love, I'm trying to talk about the ways that, say, you know, when I experience depression, I was very aware of the role that my partners were playing in supporting me, keeping me on an even keel, making sure I was like eating, and, keeping the idea alive in me that the work I was doing was worth something. Because, you know, I sort of say this too. I think a lot of people might have seen that the work was making me sad and said, give up, because you're sad. And that would have been to place happiness as the goal of my work or my life. And it isn't, right? Happiness is not the goal of my life. For me personally, it's not the goal of my work to make myself happy. So my partner's been able to see that and say, okay, so yes, this work makes you sad. I still see why it's important, and I will still support you to do it. And I will make sure that it's, you know, possible for you. That was when I saw eudaimonic love happening. And so that was what inspired me to kind of try to get this theory together that talked about what that value was, about that collaboration in the project of the work that I is doing and that we're doing together. And that even though the emotional side of things was honestly pretty dire, that didn't make it less you'd own it.
I appreciate that real world example. You know, I'm here thinking about my own relationships, right? And so if I use my like relationships with like Jason and Emily as an example, it's like, oh, well, very clearly we've had an 8-year long project, multiple projects, you know, that we've been working on together that's really kept us going. And I think really has been part of the very fundamental glue in our relationship as business owners and in our individual relationships and so on and so forth. But I'm also thinking of, you know, people who are listening to this and having that question, right, of what's the project that I'm sharing with my partner? What, especially if, you know, we're not necessarily wanting to raise a child together or not necessarily aiming to like buy a home together, something like that. You know, I think this also intersects with a lot of people who are not in escalator relationships and are kind of wondering, oh, but what are we working towards? And so I guess I'm wondering from a, like a real world perspective, it's like, do you have more examples of that or ways that you think people can kind of help to start determining that for themselves?
Yeah. I think that's a great question. And I mean, really all the examples are potentially misleading because everyone's answer has to be really very unique and tailored to them and their situations. But that said, not every goal is a huge goal. Sometimes the goal is breakfast. That's good, right? Some days, that's it. That's good. You're good. If you get that far, you're doing really well. And I'm not meaning to suggest that this has to be like you're going to write an opera or paint the Sistine Chapel, right? It can be literally anything, as long as it means something to you. For a lot of people, it can be something like kind of artistic meditative practice where they just have to get a paintbrush out and put it on the paper once a day. And yeah, so, you know, for some people, the goal of a relationship could be as simple as keeping a garden going, making something beautiful happen in your backyard or on your window box. It doesn't need to be anything grand. It doesn't have to be, you know, a great contribution to the world. It just has to be something that means something to you, right? It could be that you support other people who are going through a rough time in small personal ways, but that mean something. There's an inspiration for this comes partly out of business ethics and management studies and this this idea of job crafting, where people who are in employment, they sort of are given a job description, but then they craft it to make it cohere more with their values and what makes the work feel meaningful to them. Not everybody does this, but some people do it. And people, one of the original inspirations for this series was a janitor in a hospital who would move the paintings around on the walls to help prompt recovery, patient recovery. And it was not part of her job description, but she'd say, well, no, that's part of me, you know, to do something like that. And so I think of love that way, right? It's I talk about love crafting, meaning like you take this job description of romantic partner or whatever, and then you tweak it to make it into something that means something to you and whatever it is, right, that makes you feel that. And, you know, we all get it from something. There's this click of a feeling of satisfaction that you've contributed something, you've made a difference to someone, whether that's just, you know, yeah, it might be that you've made a successful business happen for years and years and years, or it might be that you've got them breakfast, right? It's not the size. It's size doesn't matter here. It's not about that.
As it were.
Yeah.
So it's really striking me, and I feel like I learned this from this podcast and having so many conversations about this topic and conversations with like wonderful guests like you, like how important it is to connect to your values as an individual and like together with your partners as well, connecting to what is actually meaningful here. You know, so we talked about that a lot. If people go back and listen to episode 319, that was all about that. That came up in our interview with Lola Phoenix in 378 about like finding your anchor, right? So it's, it's as you're sharing that, it's striking me how important that work is.
And that's the part that everybody is different on, right? And this is why the kind of one size fits all idea about relationships is such a disaster. And especially the one size fits all, and that one size is the happy ever after myth. It's like that size fits almost nobody. I'm not sure if it fits anyone at all. But when you come to this question about, well, what do you replace it with then we kind of get this sort of almost like an existential panic about, well, what do we replace it with? and it is a scary moment, right? When you realize, no one is going to tell me what to do with my life, what to do in my relationships, what we should do with our lives, right? And it's the same kind of question as what should I do with my life? What should we do with our time together? And it doesn't have to be that it's a whole life. It might be, you know, a shorter period of time. It might not be a grand project. It might just be what does it mean to be in this connection, in this relationship, and to be good diamonds, be good spirited.
Yeah. And just a quick question, because you call it love crafting, I assume there's also some kind of ancient tomes or pacts you're making with elder gods.
Witchcrafting, yes.
I wasn't going to mention those, but yeah.
And there's a lot of spooky stuff.
Okay, good, good.
A certain amount of tentacle action is involved.
Yeah, okay, good.
Amazing. Well, I feel like we could continue this conversation forever. I was so struck by the beauty of this idea of creating a project with your partner and how... It immediately my mind was like, wait, what does she mean by project? Like, you know, doing some sort of science project or something, but it could literally mean anything, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And it is kind of this idea of life's work and how lovely that is, that we can undertake that with a variety of people, and that will, because it is work, be challenging and be emotionally fraught at times and also be wonderful and fill one with happiness and also sadness. And it means
you
really
have
lovely
people on your team, right? For whatever happens in that process.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how wonderful that is as well. Did either of the two of you have anything else you wanted to add before we wrap up?
I don't know, Carrie, you got to come back on our show more frequently than every 6 years.
There's just so,
or maybe it's your fault. You need to put out a book more often.
I was going to say, yeah. But
it's all on you.
If I could have done this one in 3 years, I would have. But I think, honestly, it took that long for these ideas to settle properly. Mm-hmm, and sometimes that's how it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we do want to say to our audience that in addition to just all these great ideas and the fact that Carrie's thinking about all of these things, she's also a really great writer. And so just writing in the book itself is also fantastic. And sorry to compliment you so much right in front of you here, but
blush.
Indeed.
Well, but really, truly just beautiful writing as well. So definitely recommend this to everyone.
Thank you. That means a lot
to this.
And we just, before you go, what's next on the horizon for you, and where can people find more of you and your work?
And this book.
Yeah. And where can they purchase this book?
The book should be available wherever, whichever
fine books are sold.
Fine local independent bookstore you choose to go to is good for me. It's pretty much available in all the usual places. My website is carriejenkins.net, and I'm Carrie Jenkins on Twitter as well. What's next for me? I'm in the early stages of planning a second novel. I've published one, and I'm co-authoring a second novel about academia and academic life. I have another short book on non-monogamy and happiness in the works. That's under contract now, and hopefully should be appearing on on my screen any minute now. Anytime it felt like showing up there would be great. Hopefully that one would be hitting the presses in the next year or two as well.
Wonderful.
Great.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you everyone for listening. Our question of the week, which will be on our Instagram stories, is what projects do you want to undertake with your partner or partners? And the best place to share your thoughts with other listeners is on this episode discussion channel in our Discord server, or you can post in our private Facebook group. You can get access to these groups and join our exclusive community by going to patreon.com/multiamory. In addition, you can share with us publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Multiamory is created and produced by Jace Lindgren, Dedeker Winston, and me, Emily Matlack. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio Balvanetta. Our episode is researched by Dr. Kiana Nurse. Our production assistants are Rachel Schenowork and Carson Collins. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh Anand from the Fractal Cave EP, and the full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.